If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Brokers are not there to educate and teach people because their job is hard enough just to make a deal stick. Right. So I think if you come into it thinking like the residential world where you have a buyer that's going to buyer agent that's going to help you through, it's really not the way that the game gets played in commercial real estate.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Shane Melanson helps professionals and business owners invest in Canadian real estate with a focus on cash flowing commercial real estate, specifically for professionals and business owners earning a high income and too busy to find good, safe commercial real estate properties. For the past 14 years, Shane has helped Canadian real estate investors buy and sell more than $250 million worth of real estate. Shane, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Sam.
Pleasure's all mine. The pleasure's all mine. You've got an awesome background. I'm excited to jump in today. Can you give us just a quick bio or a quick overview of where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Sure. Well, I won't go on the backstory, if you will, but I think it's important just to give some context in the sense that I didn't grow up with a rich family that got me into real estate investing. Mm-hmm. Both my parents were teachers, grew up in a small town. And one of the first things I saw actually was when I was about 19, my parents invested. I mean, they refinanced their house because they thought that the investment they were going to get into was really going to set them up and allow them to, you know, take care of their family. Because my dad comes from, I think he's got 8 or 9 brothers and sisters, and my mom, a big family as well out east. Needless to say, they lost everything, right? So $100,000, refinanced their house. And when you're teachers, that essentially was 10 years of their savings gone. And seeing that kind of put me on the path, if you will, to really trying to figure out, like, how do I make money? I don't want to essentially trade my life to save up and then one day be able to retire, right? I mean, I think that worked. And, you know, certainly when you're teachers, you work for 35, 40 years, and then you get a pension. That wasn't really my game plan. And so when I graduated from university, I got into two things. One, I was investing in real estate. And the second, it was mainly residential, right? And I really got into it because I was working at the City of Calgary in urban planning and assessment. And I would have to look at sales of homes that took place in the same year. And I was starting to notice this trend where people were buying a home and then flipping it for like $150,000 or $100,000. And so I went and talked to one of the senior assessors, and he described what it was. And I said, what are the risks? How do you do that? So I bought some courses, and that was kind of how I got into quote unquote flipping and then into long-term rentals and spec homes. And then during that time, I probably about 3 years in, I went to Sun Life Financial to kind of continue my growth, if you will. And that's where I got into commercial real estate as a lender. And it was in one of our meetings about a year into the business. And I was sitting with these two guys, and they were buying a retail building for like $10 or $12 million. And I thought, like, how do these two guys, they're not a REIT, a pension fund, they're not publicly traded, they're just two individuals. And that was the first time that I got exposed to quote unquote syndications. And so that was probably in 2005, 2006, maybe something. I don't know. The dates are a little bit off, but it was a long time ago. And then I started to kind of learn a little bit more about it. And then when I met my father-in-law, he was a pretty well-known, successful commercial real estate developer. Hmm. Their family has a publicly traded company. And he brought me into the fold and showed me how to raise capital, how to find the right deals. And that was kind of in 2007.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So you already had your feet wet. Like, you kind of had a basic understanding of how this stuff worked, but then somebody else came along and just threw gasoline on the fire, basically.
Yeah, it was, I mean, there's a big difference between knowing about something and then actually doing it, right? And I know even with the clients that I work with, like the first time they go and raise capital, like the fundamentals of GPLP, 8% pref, 75-20, like, I mean, hiring a lawyer, like none of that is really all that complicated. I mean, you could Google it. I mean, there's a ton of books, like the short little book I wrote talks about it, but it's like the specifics of how do you actually approach an investor? What does an investor want to see? How do you set that first meeting up? It's all these little nuances that kind of make the difference, I think. And so even though I was aware of syndications a long time ago, it wasn't until I actually got into a deal and then you sit down belly to belly with an investor and they're just peppering you with questions, can be quite intimidating initially. And I know even for me, it was very overwhelming. With my father-in-law there, it was just a conversation. And then as you do enough of them, you know, hundreds of them, eventually, like I really look forward to it now. Like I love pitching deals, right? But I know when you first start, like anything, it's can be a little bit overwhelming.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially on the capital raise sites. Are you still with your father-in-law's company? Or are you off doing your own thing now?
Yeah. So just to make sure that there's no misinterpretation. So when Andy and I were doing business, even though his family company, we did business with them more as brokers, if you will. Mm-hmm. I was also, he and I would do our own private syndications. So this was outside of the mothership, right? Deals that were too quirky to fit inside of what they looked at. So we did 1150 acre mobile home community or land lease community. We did first mortgages across Canada. We did, well, and then I kind of broke off and did some of my own deals. I did a industrial development, a retail development. I'm doing a townhouse development now and looking at a skilled nursing facility that we're raising capital for. So it may seem like, well, Shane, you don't have a lot of focus, if you will. But what I would say is I'm focused on value add and where there's an opportunity. And then typically I'll surround myself with people that have the skill sets that I may be lacking, right? Like I know what I'm really good at, raising capital, finding deals and building teams. And then I'll bring in operational partners that really are really excellent at what it is that they do.
Right, right. Yeah, that was going to be my question is these are a lot of different asset classes to be involved in.
Yes.
How have you educated yourself and then grown each of those? And I guess the backup question to that or the question behind that would be, are you still involved in all of those asset classes today?
So we sold out of the mobile homes or land lease community in about 2015, I think it was. Hmm. We bought it in 2011. And it was a steep learning curve. So we thought that we had the right business model and we really realized that it was a business with real estate. And so all of a sudden now I'm in charge of 30 people. And at the time I was maybe, what is that, 10 years ago? So I would have been about 32, 33. And I have like 55-year-old professionals that are now reporting to me. And so I had to quickly learn how to be a leader, how to manage people, how to fire people. I didn't enjoy that aspect of it, but you quickly realize that to succeed, that you're going to have to do some pretty uncomfortable things. Sure. So look, I mean, if I was to go back in time, I would have definitely done things differently, right? In terms of, so there was kind of a fork in the road, right? I don't talk about this very often, but I took this gentleman that we were going to partner up with, I took him down into Houston and I said, look, these are the apartment buildings that I'm helping another group buy. And I think that there's still a long runway here. We went down, we looked at, because I had helped this other group buy about 750 Class A apartments in Houston and Dallas. And I had the connections. I wanted to continue to build that. Sure. He said, okay, I'll go down with you, but you have to come to Ontario, Muskoka, just north of Toronto, and look at what I'm doing. And so I went out there and being the entrepreneur, I said, wow, this is amazing, right? I mean, look at the opportunity, there wasn't a lot of competition. And so we went after it. And I'm certainly happy I did. But if I could have gone back in time and just focused and continued to buy, you know, A and B properties, I'd be much further ahead than I am today. But hindsight's always 20/20. So
right, right. So one of the things, if I'm hearing you right, you decided to invest with his other partner in Toronto, yep, as opposed to pursuing the assets you guys were pursuing in, yep, Houston and Dallas.
Correct.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's, but you never know. I mean, like you said, hindsight's 20/20. It might've been the other way around and you just said, hey, super glad we made the decisions we made.
So. Well, going back to 2013, I remember like there was bid situations then, like starting in 2011. So when we were buying these multifamily, we started in 2009, right? Wow. Right during the crash, right? That was the only way that we were getting attention from the Colliers and ARAs and JLLs of the world, right? Because even though the company I was helping was publicly traded, if you're a new entity, even in some of these well-established markets, it's like, no, I mean, we're going to go to the guy that just bought 10,000 units from us over the past 2 years, right? Like, we don't know you. We don't know if you're going to close or drop close or retrade us. But in 2009, I think the broker that we dealt with said there was four Class A multifamily over 20 million that traded, and we were one of them. So we got their attention. Mm. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that was kind of what they had suggested. And the fact that she called me back after I literally, you know, I messaged a guy in Austin. He said, I don't have any deals that fit your criteria. Contact this person in Houston, sent her a message. We're on a phone. I was on a plane 2 days later and I was touring this apartment building. We had it under contract and it just kind of went from there. But today, that would be pretty unlikely in the sense that you would get that top broker that's doing $1 billion a year in transactions to take an unsolicited phone call. Now, back then, LinkedIn, I think, was maybe a little more, it was less used too, right? So I was able to build some connections with people. Anyways, I don't know. We got off topic there, but.
No, I think that's great. This is your story. And this is how you learn from, you know, from others like yourself who have done it. What have been some moments of trepidation or of, I guess, maybe that's just the right word, but you're like, wow, am I in over my head? Like, have you had those moments?
I would say, and I don't know if this is just unique to me or even for yourself, Sam, but like anytime I get close to removing conditions, I'm always looking at the deal saying, did I miss something? What am I not seeing? And I always kind of push through that fear. But I got to tell you, there's generally not a deal that I do that I don't really question whether or not I should be, you know, pursuing this. Like, what am I missing, right? Like, because especially on the last two developments I did, or even the last three, like you're signing your house off, right? You're putting up personal guarantees, and because it's personal, that means my wife also has to look at it, right? And so she will always look at me and say, like, are you sure, right? Because mm-hmm. I got three kids and I don't want to be out on the street type of thing. Right. So you got a strong gut check when you're doing those kind of deals.
Have you gone back in any of those strong gut check moments and found some things that you maybe had overlooked?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you about a deal that I recently walked away from and it was a big deal. It would have been the thing I think people realize or when they get into commercial real estate is like one deal is the equivalent of maybe multiple six figures, right? So it can cover your entire year type of thing. And I had the money raised. We had about $5 million raised. We had the investors teed up. We were about 2 weeks away from removing conditions. Building condition came back okay. We brought out our general contractor and he said, you know, did you know this? I don't want to get into the specifics just because of legalities and whatnot, sure. But just suffice to say that it was sufficient that we just had to press pause. And we said, you know what, we're not comfortable moving ahead based on what we know now. And so someone else saw the same risk and they went forward with it. Right. But we just didn't feel comfortable to be able to sleep at night, raise $5 million from, you know, half a dozen high net worth guys, because the way I look at it is you're always one deal away from being out of business in this world, right? Like maybe that's not true, but that's how serious I take it, right? I never want to lose, you know, my investors' money and confidence. So
Right. But you know, you were still within the due diligence period, it sounds
yep.
like.
And it was.
Yeah. I mean, that's the point of the period, is so you can get through it and find out, is this actually something we, you know, are willing to take on? So yeah. That's and good for you for, you know, having the courage to walk away. What did your investors say about that?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that came out of it, first of all, they just said, thank you, right? You know, for, because they don't really know, right? They don't see that you spent 4 months, $40,000 on due diligence, right. All this energy and time, and it's really not up to them. But here's one of the things. So this is kind of good for people that maybe haven't raised capital before, because I think sometimes when you haven't raised money before, you always wonder like, well, do I earn do I deserve the fees that I'm getting, right? Because they can be significant. Well, I guarantee, and I know because now I've had a few of them kind of reach out to me independently, the trust level has gone way up, right? Because they know that we're not forcing a deal. And two is like when we go back and raise capital, because on that deal, they actually grinded us. There was two people that kind of grinded us a bit on the splits instead of 75-25. And I think it was an 8%. They wanted 80-20, right? And it's like, look, I mean, fine. I'm not going to, you know, I was going to say split hairs, like neither of us have hair, but you know what I mean? They were not going to get into an argument over something like this,
sure.
Especially when they could have been very big investors for us. Right. I'm pretty sure when we go back to them the next time, it's not going to be an issue because they see the value that we bring to the table, right? It's one thing to say it. It's another thing to demonstrate it, right? And we didn't, you know, you as a GP, you don't go back and say, hey guys, this is the due diligence. This is how much time we put into it. You know, how do we get comped for it? I mean, that just doesn't happen, right? So.
Right. And that's something that, you know, I think that's an important thing that you bring to investors is that we do invest incredible amounts of time and money totally. Up front that they, that, you know, that the limited partners just don't get exposed to. And so, you know, that's another thing that capital raisers, I think, need to keep in mind is when you're asked, why are you worth this? Well, because you don't see all the lost deals and the amount of time we put in to bring you this deal that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. You might look at 40 or 50 or 10 or whatever. Like, I mean, certainly you can underwrite a lot of properties, then you're going to tour some, then you're going to put some under contract, you're going to spend some legal, then you're going to do diligence. And yeah, I mean, I was literally talking to a friend of mine who's getting into commercial real estate now, and he comes from the residential world. And he's like, Shane, he's like, I could go 18 months without doing a deal. I said, yeah, that can happen in commercial real estate, right? Mm-hmm. But just understand, when you do one, it's going to make up for the 40 friggin' flips that you did over the past. And now you have an asset versus being on a treadmill. At least that's how I look at it. And he's like, yeah, I know. And anyway, so it's just a different mindset, right? So
it sure is. Yeah, it absolutely sure is. Let's talk about development a little bit here, if you don't mind. I think development is something that people are commonly afraid of, and especially in this kind of market cycle. What do you see on the development front for opportunities? And I guess, why do you see that?
Well, I guess one of the things I'm always looking at in a market is like, where's the pendulum? And so in terms of supply and demand, and then where's the opportunity? And these are just my beliefs, right? And sure. And so I'm in Calgary, and this is kind of what I'm seeing, but I've got people across Canada and even in the US. So I get a lot of feedback from different markets. And let's face it, I mean, if you're investing in value-add multifamily, I mean, everybody and their dog's a friggin' multifamily syndicator these days, right? I mean, just, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just understand that if there's 50 people chasing one deal, they're bidding up the price and dropping the cap. And so sometimes it could be the more unsophisticated investor that takes that deal down. Not always, but you know, I think that you're going to have to search through a lot more properties to find something that makes sense.
Right.
So on the development side, there's far few people that can execute on a development, that can have that patience, that like even myself, now that I've been through a few developments, I still have a business partner that I raise most of the money, but he's got 25 years experience of doing development, right? And I can lean on my family, you know, the mothership, I call it, you know, to be able to tap into some resources and talk to people that are doing it. And so, you know, I wouldn't suggest if someone is new to commercial real estate to jump into development. Like, I mean, it was probably 8 years before I got into it. And even then I had people that could really make sure that I wasn't going to make a mistake. Like you and I could talk for the next hour on all the little things that I've uncovered in terms of doing a development. And you know, from geotech to tapping into city services and getting, you know, like, does the land as it's zoned today, does it comply with the type of uses that we're, you know, we've had to rezone a land and that takes longer. And now all of a sudden it's politics. And, you know, so there's all these nuances, but I enjoy it. And now that I understand more of the risks, I can kind of quantify it and say, okay, when I go to my investors, here's how I do my deal. So I'll give you one kind of strategy. I try to remove as much risk upfront as I can. And so what that usually means is either pre-leasing or pre-sales. And so I like to, when I remove my conditions, I like to be break even on the deal. So if the worst case happens, then I'm at least break even. I can pay the bank back. Right. And so I didn't give you an example or.
Well, I'm just curious how that works. I mean, can you give us the mechanics of that?
Sure. So what I'll do is I'll give myself enough time on due diligence, right? So on the industrial condos, we gave ourselves 4 months due diligence, right? And so let's say, and on the retail development, we had 3 months. And so what that gave us was enough time to put together a site plan, to talk to our, even though I'm a broker, I could have done it myself. I knew my time wasn't best spent there, right? So we hired the agents, paid them lots of money, and they went out and pre-sold or pre-leased. And on the retail development, we had an anchor tenant that came in. They covered basically the nut, meaning everything after that, which was about half the site, was going to be upside. Mm-hmm. And on the industrial condos, we sold 70% before we removed conditions. And then the next 30 days, we actually pre-sold the balance. Now, some people that are experienced in development might say, well, you left money on the table, right? Because you're capping your upside, right? When you pre-sell everything, so in a high-rise condo, you wouldn't do that because you want to keep some back, because the market, especially if you're in a growth market. For context, we were in Calgary and we were flat because oil had taken such a beating from 15 to, well, now it's finally coming back up. But back then I was more worried about my downside. And so I was fine to cap my upside, get a fixed price contract from our general contractor, and really just focus on like, let's hit the numbers that we need. As soon as we hit those numbers, we crept them up a little bit. And so we were selling, you know, between 300 and 310 a foot for our industrial condos.
Right. And so you've got these all sold prior to ever putting a shovel in the ground.
Correct.
Wow. Wow, that's really cool. I mean, like you said, I mean, that protects your downside, you know, and that that's rule number one, isn't it? Never lose money.
Well, and it's an easy way to raise money too. Like if you think about how a lot of people raise capital, they're trying to, especially on a development, it's like an idea, right? We think we're going to be able to do this.
Right.
And I was able to go to them and say, well, we actually have deposits in our lawyer's trust account of X. We have it pre-sold to this point, right? I mean, like we didn't even have our condo bylaws formulated at this point, right? Like it was just, I almost worked backwards and said, like, what are all the things that are going to hurt us in this deal? And then what are the things that I can get my lawyers and everybody else to kind of work on the important stuff, but it's not important to me, right? Like I don't really care about X, Y, and Z in the condo bylaws. Like that to me is like a foregone conclusion. You know, it's going to happen. So, yeah.
Man, that's super cool. That's a creative way. It's a very creative way to, again, protect your downside, I think, in development deals like that. That's not one. And again, like you've said, and that's something I've struggled with in development deals and raising money for them, is you go, wait, this is an idea. Yeah. We're projecting that maybe someday we'll make money on this if. Whereas you can go to them and say, well, we've already got signed contracts. Here's the papers. As long as the papers are good and the people that are signing the contracts, you know, follow through, then, I mean, you're set.
So. Well, and I'll just touch on that real quick. One of the things I told our sales guys, because one of the things I learned from Muskoka, right? So you learn all these things. And so one of the things I learned when I was selling these mobile homes or cottages, we call them, is we'd sell 10 in a weekend and four people would rescind within 48 hours.
Oh, wow.
And so it was just, you know, there was buyer's remorse, right? Sure. And so back then what we would do is we would like send chocolates and flowers to the place of work. And so that they, you know, not just because we cared, but obviously we wanted them to see it through. So we were able to take that, say 40%, you know, of people that were killing their deals down to maybe 10 or 20%, right? And so that was huge. So what did I do? How did I take that same concept to Muskoka or to our condos? I told our guys to oversell them. I said, sell it to 125, get backup offers. Because I know what's going to happen when it comes down to closing, they're either going to try to grind me on price, which they did, and they're going to want the refund or whatever it happens to be. And I said, like, if you just look at human psychology, people want what they can't have. And so if they know that someone else is going to step into their shoes and either pay more or close, and I'll keep their deposit because that would be the contract, then they'll close. And every one of them closed. I mean, it wasn't without some, you know, some back and forth, sure. But I tell you, it makes someone feel good to know that there's someone else that will step into their shoes. Right. And so that was just kind of my sales guys are like, well, I don't think we can do that. I'm like, yeah, what do you mean you can't take backup offers? I said, like, I'd rather have 2x backup offers, like keep going.
Right. But yeah, what's it cost you to have a backup offer? Nothing. And what's it cost a backup offer to be a backup offer? Probably nothing. I mean, that's a win-win. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Shane, this has been awesome. I've really enjoyed, you know, our time today. I do appreciate it. Let's jump here into the final four. The first question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
I think one of the biggest things, and this isn't self-serving, it's just like really find someone that can shepherd you through the deal. And I will say this, I'm a broker myself. Brokers are not there to educate and teach people because their job is hard enough just to make a deal stick. Right. So I think if you come into it thinking like the residential world where you have a buyer that's going to, you know, buyer agent that's going to help you through, it's really not the way that the game gets played in commercial real estate. So just find someone that's going to have your back, right? That has no strings attached, that really wants to see you protected all the way through. That would be my biggest piece of advice.
Right. No, I love that. That's great. Question number two is this: when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you were doing to stay on top of your game?
I'm big on reading. I'm big on my own coaches and mentors that I've got right now. I mean, I hired Oren Claff about a year ago and work with him and Daniel. And so I practice what I preach. I wouldn't just say, hey, go find someone if I didn't do it myself, right? And my father-in-law, he's still a mentor, right? I'm constantly learning. I don't think that you ever get to the point where you have it mastered in commercial real estate.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
For me, I mean, I've got three kids, and one of the things I'm constantly trying to do is teach them, empower them, right? Always do your best, have a great attitude, and, you know, did you help someone else, right? And so if I can get my three kids and then, you know, close friends and family that I can kind of help, I mean, I love coaching others, but I think you got to start as close to home as possible, right?
Right. No, absolutely, man. Absolutely. No, that's awesome. Good for you. Yeah. If you can get three kids out the door and on the right track, you've done something. you should chalk that up as a success. That's awesome, man. Shane, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
My website's pretty easy to find. Just my name, Shane Melanson, MelanSon.com. And then from there, you can check out my book and podcast and all that kind of stuff. So
that's awesome. Shane, thank you so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.